I'd like to introduce another of our organizing committee members, the professor in the UCSB Department of Dramatic Art and Dance, Davies King.
Am I on the air okay?
Yeah.
All right. So I'd like to begin with the now standard apology for the outreach or reach out of this. Many people have made that apology. I think you will find that this paper deserves it in a big way. It's sort of a Lord have mercy on my soul paper. So my research, as you heard, is in the area of dramatic art, specifically the field of theater history, much of it concentrated lately in the 19th century, and thus far, one would think, from the issues of contemporary physics and studies of the consciousness problem, and even contemporary drama. The question I have been investigating is, how does the word darkness function in 19th century performance, darkness in all its connotations? The 19th century was the era when darkness became an effect you could produce in the theater owing to advances in lighting technology. And it is no accident that 19th century theater artists used this effect repeatedly, especially in melodrama. You look at the fourth act of a five-act melodrama, or the third act of a four-act melodrama, and you will almost always encounter a scene in a dark cave or a cellar or some space enveloped by the night. Where virtue is most threatened, there will be darkness. I argue that the 19th century theater became ironically focused on darkness in all its many connotations as a metaphor of the unknown, the irrational, magic, evil, the unconscious, the feminine, the racial other, and so on. Furthermore, I relate this irony to a reaction to the values of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was, of course, the crucial period for the establishment of the values and principles of modern science and the basic paradigms of scientific investigation through experiment. Also, the political values we associate with a liberal society. And I argue that the 19th century theater's fixation on darkness represented a reaction to Enlightenment paradigms. Performance became a send-up of experiment, and the fascination with darkness became a way of subverting the scientific paradigm of seeing. Seeing in the dark is not scientifically possible, and yet what one nevertheless sees in the dark deserves analysis and demands analysis at exactly that point where the paradigm of seeing scientifically gives way to the freakish possibilities of performance. At issue were the terms of knowing and freedom. My study, which began in theater history, has taken me beyond plays to other sorts of theatrical showmanship, including performances of strange science, strange religion, spiritualism, magic, and mesmerism or hypnotism. It is in this last vein of study that I came upon a remarkable story, one that I feel sure that no one in this room has ever heard, one that speaks directly to the issues of this conference. The story concerns a hypnotist named Henry Edward Lewis, who was said to be a practitioner of truly unusual ability. He surfaces first in Scotland, in Edinburgh, late in 1850, and the last trace I have found of him is from 1852. But I know he was an American from Virginia. Following a recent development in marginally scientific theory in the United States, he called what he did electrobiology. Two or three other American electrobiologists appear to have made the journey to Britain along with him, including a man named H.G. Darling. And they separately offered demonstrations of their powers to paying audiences in the largest meeting halls of the cities. It was science as theater, or pseudoscience as pseudo-theater. They had different means of inducing a trance. Dr. Darling used a zinc disc with a copper center. But Lewis alone was able to induce a trance by the sheer force of his gaze. He could then lead his subjects, by verbal commands alone, to feel alternately hot, then shivering cold, to flap their arms like a bird, and to forget their very own names. A piano would be taken for a horse, water for milk or wine. The British public had seen demonstrations of animal magnetism before. However, these American displays were unusually theatrical, and in fact, they reflect the basic routine for hypnotic showmanship to the present day, the sort of stuff you see in fairgrounds. Lewis believed that he was inducing his subjects to effect a physical change in their own nervous systems by these electrobiological means. At this time, there was a lively debate in British scientific circles over whether a physiological or psychological mechanism was at work in what one Manchester scientist, James Braid, had recently started calling hypnotism. Braid preferred the psychological explanation, arguing for suggestion, and he introduced the new term to distinguish himself from those who argued for a physical cause, usually called animal magnetism. The groundwork of a new line of thinking about psychology was just being laid, but some scientists persisted in thinking that mesmerism could still be traced to physical causes, and the Americans attracted their attention. The new word electrobiology evoked the image, the entrancing image, of flowing forces. Shortly before this time, in the 1840s, the Baron von Reichenbach in Germany claimed discovery of a new physical force called ode, or the odic force. In a series of formidable scientific or pseudoscientific publications over about 20 years, he claimed this force was observable only by sensitives, this is his term, and only after remaining for several hours in utter darkness, at which point the sensitives could see a faint blue light coming from magnets, crystals, and fingertips. Two English translations of the Baron's principal book on this subject came out in Scotland in 1851, and both translators saw in this newly discovered dark energy, so to speak, a possible means of explaining animal magnetism. One of the translators was William Gregory, professor of chemistry at the University of Edinburgh, and that same year he studied both Lewis and Darling in his laboratory in the company of other eminent scientists, attempting to account for their powers in terms of what he called the odylic force, something he hoped to measure and experiment upon in the way of any good scientist. Gregory himself had not observed this force, as he was not a sensitive, and neither was Reichenbach. But he could clearly see that these electrobiologists were having a powerful effect on their subjects, and Gregory persisted in thinking of this effect in physical terms, specifically forces that came out of the darkness. The scientists were especially impressed by Mr. Lewis, since he was obviously also committed to investigating the science behind these powers, while Dr. Darling came off as more of a showman. They reported that Lewis had amazing powers, both in public performance and in the laboratory. Professor Gregory eventually came to believe that Lewis was capable of demonstrating some of the so-called higher powers of mesmerism, including the induction of clairvoyance in his subjects. Gregory recounts an episode in which Lewis magnetized a Scottish lady of 17 and then induced her to visit America. She accurately described the Astor House Hotel, Niagara Falls, and an especially filthy area of Buffalo. Quote, she was then made by silent volition to visit Louisville and the slave market there, which horrified her much. End quote. Lewis also induced another young subject, a young Scottish man, to visit, by way of clairvoyance, New Brunswick, Canada. There, the young man encountered none other than Lewis's mother. I should add at this point that another unusual thing about Lewis was that he was African American. That Lewis induced the clairvoyance to see the Louisville slave market and his mother in Canada leads one to wonder if he might have been an escaped slave off to Britain along with the wave of other escapees previously harbored in the North who fled the United States following the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850. I became interested in Lewis when I read Fanny Kemble's description of him in one of her volumes of memoir. Kemble was a very prominent English actress of the period. Late in 1850, Kemble was a visitor at the house of the famous phrenologist George Combe when Lewis was present. Kemble sat beside a doctor of science, a Dr. Becker, whom Lewis sought to throw into a, quote, mesmeric state of somnolence under the influence of the operator, end quote. And then this is her description. He presently began his experiment, and drawing entirely from his coat and shirt sleeve a long, lithe, black hand, the fingertips of which were of that pale, livid tinge so common in the hands of Negroes, he directed it across the table towards Dr. Becker and began slowly making passes at him. We were all profoundly still and silent, and in spite of my disgust, I watched the whole scene with considerable interest. By degrees, the passes became more rapid, and the hand was stretched nearer and nearer toward its victim, waving and quivering like some black snake, while the face of the operator assumed an expression of the most concentrated, powerful purpose, which, combined with his sable color and the vehement, imperative gestures which he aimed at Dr. Becker, really produced a quasi-diabolical effect. End quote. Kemble was not a skeptic about animal magnetism. Indeed, based in part on her experience as an actress, she acknowledged her belief in some sort of influence, indeed a physical influence, by which one person might have effect on the will of another. But something gave her pause in the face of H.E. Lewis. She saw some darkness there that offended her sense of reason, and in this case she referred that darkness, a loaded metaphorical term, to his race. Kemble had earlier lived for a short time on an American plantation in Georgia until she fled from her naive marriage to the master because of her horror at the practice of slavery. And yet this description of Lewis literally demonizes him, at least partially on the basis of race. But it is clear her perception of his darkness goes deeper. In one formidable sentence from the same section of her memoir, Kemble expresses the power of performance to disturb an enlightened or scientific perspective on human experience, as performance necessarily insinuates a darkness. And this is her very long sentence. Believing entirely in a sort of hitherto undefined and possibly undefinable physical influence by which the nervous system of one person may be affected by that of another, by special exercise of will and effort, so as to produce an almost absolute temporary subserviency of the whole nature to the force by which it is acted upon, and therefore thinking it extremely possible and not improbable that many of the instances of mesmeric influence I have heard related had some foundation in truth, I have, nevertheless, kept entirely aloof from the whole subject, never voluntarily attended any exhibitions of such phenomena, and regarded the whole series of experiments and experiences and pretended marvels of the numerous adepts in mesmerism with contempt and disgust. Contempt for the crass ignorance and glaring dishonesty involved in their practices, and disgust because of the moral and physical mischief their absurd juggleries were likely to produce, and in many instances did produce, upon subjects as ignorant but less dishonest than the charlatans by whom they were duped. The project of enlightenment and of science since then was to chase all forms of deception out of knowledge, including superstition, selfish delusion, and deliberate or inadvertent manipulation of evidence. The mesmerists, and in Kemble's mind, also most of the theater artists, represented an especially gross corruption of knowledge because they took advantage of credulous audiences for money and because they stood in the way of a properly scientific investigation of influence. Enlightenment said that a properly disciplined scientific method would reliably yield knowledge and understanding. But what defense could there be against an unruly or disorderly performance, read experiment? The pitfall of a system based in the empirical and the repeatable, that is, based in science, is the unique performance, the unaccountable performance or experiment. And every performance or experiment is initially, in its time, just that, an opening up of the possibility of pure anomaly or miracle incarnate. Enlightenment prefers the world whole, complete, fulfilled, law-abiding, the world unchangeable in repetition, lacking mystery or miracle, fixed in fact. Enlightenment prefers the world clear in light, not obscure in darkness. Reason puts the single case into continuity. that is, into science, by seeing the pattern, the unity that is its law. But each new case introduces the possibility of radical discontinuity, something beyond law. Performances command belief, and belief has the power to undermine rational understanding. Performance continually opens the possibility of the emergence of an exception to the rule, a darkness in the midst of enlightenment. Science does this too at the point of paradigm shift. The structure of scientific revolutions allows for the accumulation of exceptions to the accepted paradigm, ultimately necessitating a shift of paradigm when the point comes where the exceptions themselves suggest a new rule. But those exceptions are understood to be observed within the strictly controlled conditions of scientific observation. That is, a paradigm of seeing controls the way scientific revolutions themselves are seen. In this essay, I want to suggest, or at least hint, that the terms of performance itself, in its very indeterminacy, might form the basis for a different paradigm of seeing, one that might help the recent investigations of consciousness come into a dialogue with the new physics. And I also want to suggest that the early history of hypnotism, indeed the whole line of what Fanny Kemble and scientists generally have dismissed as fake or crackpot or jugglery, might offer important ideas about how to understand consciousness in terms of the new physics and vice versa. Darkness is the key. What compels me about the theater and its history is its power to make meaning of experience, that is, to bring consciousness into consciousness. Dramatic performance is a highly developed computer that takes the data of human experience and processes them into meaningful form. Plays do not reduce experience to digital bytes, ones and zeros, but instead use a combination of analog data, technical simulations, and fictional constructions, such as metaphors, illusions, and mythic iterations, to make the experience of time in its passage deeply meaningful. Perception, memory, dream, emotion, reason, all coalesce in the experience of performance. Performance is like life, but distinctly different. Performance coordinates a certain kind of data with a certain kind of processing to produce a certain kind of recognition. The experience is meaningful. Indeed, it is occasionally good science in a way that life is not. And yet, as the drama critics sadly recognize, that meaningful experience cannot be downloaded into prose. It can only be downloaded into performance. The corollary of this is that there is something non-computable about performance. Whereas computers can push the logic of absolute causality to an extreme, performance will always outstrip computers in the examination of indeterminacy, ambiguity, absence, perversity, anomaly, the preposterous, and the wonderful, because performance integrates darkness. These are the wild words that don't sit easily in scientific discourse. Nevertheless, that list is the great menu from which theater artists order. By the way, chaos is another term that might be on that list, also uncertainty. The word theater in its origin means a place for seeing. It shares with theory a root in the verb to see. Ancient Greek performances took place in large open-air theaters in sunlight, but the plays that were presented all focused on a darkness, something invisible and beyond rationality, something unknown. Theaters were geometrically circular, and the center of the circle was an altar, which was the locus of the god Dionysus, who was a figure of that darkness, wildness, chaos, ambiguity, etc. In a variety of ways, which I don't have time to elaborate, the theater is, in its origins and in its essence, configured as a seeing centered on a darkness. This is a potent metaphor for the paradigm I'm suggesting here. However, I have broadened the scope of what constitutes performance beyond drama to other sorts of performance, such as these theatrical demonstrations of electrobiology. H.E. Lewis is a minor figure in the history of hypnotism, and perhaps merely an unusual anecdote in the history of African Americans, but he is fascinating from the point of view of what I called in an earlier essay, darkness itself in performance. This pseudo-Kantian term reflects my elaboration of the argument of Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno in the Dialectic of Enlightenment. According to them, the Enlightenment's effort to rationalize human behavior along the same lines as scientists rationalize physical phenomena, led to a depersonalization of human agency, even as it promoted the concept of free will and the liberal self, as well as liberation from superstition. Horkheimer and Adorno understand that the image of a rationalized state conceived in liberty, etc., they conceive that image as itself a deception and an instrument of social control. Far from experiencing liberation, the human subject came to simulate freedom and subjectivity and enlightened thought, even as it was, in fact, becoming a function of the rationalized state, a robot, if you will, locked in its own unconsciousness. In my earlier paper, I posited the darkness in the sense of all those mysteries and myths which the Enlightenment sought to eradicate, persevered as manifestations of darkness in performance. And thus, in some sense, they might be regarded as lingering traces of the self not subject to Enlightenment structures. Such counter-Enlightenment phenomena as spiritualism, magic, melodrama, and belief in the supernatural all feature darkness in that they rely on the unforeseen, the irrational, the case that leaps beyond causality. Baconian science hinges upon the repeatable experiment, but performance always opens the possibility of anomalous results, that one time, mysteriously repeatable, when the magician shows that gravity does not apply, when the spiritualist medium speaks to the dead, or when the African-American electrobiologist induces clairvoyance. Scientists customarily ignore these miracles, presuming them to be deceptions or delusions. Occasionally, they test the wondrous phenomena by the known methods of science and expose a causal sequence to account for them according to their paradigm. It might be trickery, it might be self-deception or unclear thinking. Still, there exists the possibility that any one performance might defy the paradigmatic understanding. And in any case, experience shows that audiences, including audiences of scientists, have a willingness to believe in defiance of reason or the paradigmatic construct of the rational. Perhaps it is even a need. The very definition of freedom requires the possibility of transcending imposed order or rules. Otherwise, the human being really is a robot or a slave. Science, too, admits the possibility of transcending order or rules, and in fact, it often depends on the exceptional case. I suggest that, for this reason, performance might open a paradigm that goes beyond current science in its capacity to integrate factuality and belief, reason and unreason. Indeed, I believe that performance, because it is the art of experience, might open a window onto the mind-body question itself and explain why it seems to many to be insoluble. The fact that H.E. Lewis could make his subjects believe that water was wine seemed to certain spectators a gross blasphemy, a challenge of the very miracles at the foundation of Christian belief. That such a wonder should be produced in the name of science only heightened the sense of aporia in this performance. The irony was heightened by the fact that the effect was produced by an African American, since it seemed obvious that the will of the subject was enslaved to the electrobiologist. These are aspects of the story I explore at greater length in the extended version of this essay. Here I would like to concentrate on the fact that this performance of science openly demonstrated the effect of social control to the degree that it showed that the very contents of one's own experience might be altered by induced clairvoyance. Hypnosis eludes scientific explanation to some degree, even to this day. What trick of unconscious thought, of distracted attention, of suggestibility leads such a thing to happen? And it does happen, even up to the standards of scientific verification, though beyond explanation. Empirical evidence can be assembled to show that something is happening, brain scans, physiological measurements, behaviors that can reliably be produced in a statistically significant set of subjects, etc. More strikingly, in the 1840s, practitioners were performing painful surgical procedures, including leg amputation, on hypnotized subjects, apparently without pain. Nerves were being stimulated, and in the worst imaginable way, but the subjective experience did not include pain. Such examples point to a detachment between physical causation and subjective effect, as do many performances of hypnotism. Indeed, these cases seem to have the quality of amazing stories, believe it or not, and yet they are true. However, the medical scientific world at the time dismissed the evidence supplied by witnesses precisely because an element of fiction, scandalous rumor, or the marvels of stage magicians seemed to cling to them. According to the structure of scientific revolutions, science both wants and does not want a marvelous story. A dull story would confirm an existing paradigm, while a marvelous one might demand a whole new way of thinking. For most people, though, the marvelous and true story has tremendous power to shape belief, whatever scientists might say, however they might scoff. If the sawn leg drops off without a scream of pain, if the Scottish woman describes the Astor Hotel with convincing detail, if the voice of a dead relative speaks out of the darkness of a seance, the observer's experience of reality will be reshaped to some degree around that perception. Crowd theory has long looked to hypnotism as an explanation, however vague, for control of mass belief. The leader of the crowd stands in for the hypnotist and wields a godlike power over the perception, understanding, and action of the group. Theater artists have long exploited this effect. The furor surrounding electrobiology in 1851 can be understood as a battle not merely among competing theories, but between A, scientific conviction that the mystery would soon be cleared up, and B, a less easily defined impulse that said some primal darkness glimpsed in the phenomena would resist perpetually rationalizing. I accept Horkheimer and Adorno's association of the former, A, with an abstracted form of social domination, an insistence on conformity to what scientists defined as reasonable, and I propose that the latter, B, can be understood as reflective of the effort of the self to free itself from subjection. I want to argue here that this unusual case of dark performance associated ironically with an African-American mesmerist who was a figure of enslavement can be read as a representative anecdote of the disruptive power inherent in performance or darkness itself in the theater. Public fascination with the performances of the electrobiologists came largely from the observation that the will of a free agent could be controlled by someone else and could, in fact, be made to perform in a way that was clearly fictional. Water would taste like wine. Professor Gregory himself glimpsed the consequences of such a performance. Quote, "We can readily understand how anyone possessed of this knowledge in an age of ignorance might acquire the reputation of being a bought slave to Satan, from whom, at the cost of his soul, he had obtained his powers." End quote. Being a slave to Satan, one might subject another to the delusions that are instrumental to nefarious purpose, to domination. Gregory relies on the belief that the Enlightenment has taken society beyond this age of ignorance, and by the power of science has liberated the present age and obviated the possibility of such an ungodly subjugation. Nevertheless, others were not so optimistic, as can be seen in this review of Gregory's book. Quote, "If the facts of mesmerism be true, then one individual possesses or may possess such a power over another as totally to destroy his will, render him no longer a free agent, and in fact deprive him of responsibility as in the most severe attack of mania. If such be the case, it is obviously contrary to the intentions of the deity as manifested in the moral constitution of man. The mere fact of the possible suspension and assumption by one individual of the will, reason, and judgment of another is at once and ipso facto a violation of the laws of man's moral constitution." Another wrote, "This is sin, to suspend the will of the responsible creature and yet to give him power and action, and that action entirely under the sway of another, to do good or evil as he commands it. The essence of sin consists in doing anything contrary to our Father's will. Therefore, he has given us our will free, and we must not allow it to be brought under bondage to that of any creature, but ever to keep it responsible to himself." End quote. In short, the diabolical aspect of mesmerism is that it denies free agency, and in fact enslaves, or at least enacts enslavement. This Christian critique of mesmerism can hardly be distinguished from a critique of American slavery that was being voiced in Scotland at exactly the same moment. Conceiving the human being in terms of the programmable robot, the figure of no will, raised fundamental theological and political questions, as do the concepts of many consciousness theorists today. The Enlightenment sought to carry rationality into human experience, creating the human sciences to rationalize behavior. But human beings, unlike Turing machines or computers, can and do perform in ways that are wrong, unpredictable, disorderly, even perverse. Horkheimer and Adorno regard spiritualist seances and ghost sightings as antagonistic gestures toward Enlightenment structures. They are dark responses to an oppressive ideology enforced by rationalized society. Science, with its power of demonstration and its remote, specialized language, is weak against overwhelming belief. If people will believe in the persistence of the dead, or odic forces, or clairvoyance, or the Holy Spirit, the equations and calculations and empirical proofs of the laboratory folk will not stand in the way. Those who hold to the authority of science find themselves like a small force resistant against a mob of what they can only see as murky thought, superstition, and desire. Many scientists try their best to ignore that outlaw thinking because it gets in the way of clear, cold analyses. Yet it is a stubborn fact that a deep and enduring fascination with darkness is a component of much human experience. And so it is no accident, I think, that the metaphor of darkness surfaces so powerfully in contemporary physics in dark matter and dark energy, or that the image of the black hole comes to describe nothing quite so vividly as science itself, from which no clarity comes forth though enormous amounts of energy flow in. Or that science writings, especially in physics, are pervaded more and more by the language of weirdness, freakishness, anomaly, and a growing sense that the paradigm of scientific seeing is giving way. It is giving way, it seems to me, because science never has given sufficient place to darkness. Quote, "A picture held us captive," wrote Wittgenstein. "It lay in our language, and language seemed to repeat it to us endlessly," end quote. That picture was the image of Plato's cave with its inescapable equivalency of seeing and knowing and light. What was left behind in that cave? It was darkness and performance, which were to have no place in the ideal city. I've used my time just setting this up so that I have no time left to say what is this performance with its darkness in the midst of the scene that might form the basis of a different paradigm. Fundamentally, performance is not a picture. It integrates the visible and the experiential, reason and belief, causality and the unpredictable in a structure with multiple agencies such that light in all its connotations coexists with darkness in all its connotations. And finally, it takes the measure of the preposterous, which is where belief dwells and where science perhaps wants to go. Thank you.